Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have liftoff of Falcon 9.
What if, going forward, rocket science is the easy part for the space industry? From moon hotels to colonies on Mars, companies hoping to profit from outer space all face the same question. Is it legal? The final frontier is starting to look a lot like the Wild West. Growing numbers of private businesses have fortune-seeking schemes, but many of their plans remain in something of a legal gray area. Everything that happens in space falls under an international agreement called the Outer Space Treaty, but it marked its 50th birthday this year, and it's safe to say a few things have changed. Space reporter Adam Mann takes us on a field trip.
Starting?
Yep.
To the Chabot Space and Science Center outside of San Francisco.
We are looking at a pretty ordinary looking rock, the only difference being somebody brought this rock back from the moon. Specifically, this was a rock that was picked up on the Apollo 15 mission. So the reason why this is actually interesting and relevant is because this rock, which was brought back by American astronauts, is currently U.S. property. This is property of the federal government, as are all of the other moon rocks that the Apollo astronauts brought back, which included hundreds of kilograms of rocks. And those rocks are owned by the United States. They have been loaned out to other countries for their scientists to use. We've given them as gifts. And there are space lawyers who argue that because the United States did this, and because nobody else complained about it, that because of that, we can mine asteroids and the moon.
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the future of everything.
America must expand commerce and ultimately settlement into space, and we must do it first.
That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz at a Senate subcommittee hearing in April.
This is an issue that not only impacts our global competitiveness, but also our national security. The world is much safer with America as the global leader on this planet. And the world will similarly be safer and stronger if the United States and our ideals of free enterprise and free speech are the driving force of commerce and settlement throughout the galaxy.
During years of political gridlock in Washington, space has been one of the few things both parties have been able to agree on.
We will work with a growing array of private companies competing to make getting to space easier and more affordable.
That's then-President Barack Obama speaking at the Kennedy Space Center in 2010.
Now, I recognize that some have said it is unfeasible or unwise to work with the private sector in this way. I disagree. The truth is, NASA has always relied on private industry to help design and build the vehicles that carry astronauts to space.
The Space Act of 2015 was signed into law by President Obama. This year, President Donald Trump signed a bill aimed at sending people to Mars.
We should also thoroughly review the United Nations Outer Space Treaty.
Senator Cruz.
Which was written and enacted in a very different time and era in 1967. It's important that Congress evaluate how that treaty, enacted 50 years ago, will impact new and innovative activity within space as well as potential settlement throughout the galaxy.
What is the Outer Space Treaty? How did it come about? And what does it mean for commercial space companies?
It starts way back in 1957.
Space reporter Adam Mann.
The Soviet Russians launched Sputnik, which was the first artificial satellite. And it flew over the entire Earth, including over the United States, and it really freaked people out. It really scared everybody in the United States, all the way up to President Eisenhower.
CBS Television presents a special report on Sputnik 1, the Soviet space satellite. Douglas Edwards reporting.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this Earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from man's farthest frontier, the radio signal transmitted by the Soviet Sputnik, the first man-made satellite as it passed over New York earlier today.
the Soviets might have actually done us a good turn because they orbited over our heads and we didn't complain about it. And that establishes, in an international way, the concept of the freedom of access to space. You are allowed to fly your stuff over another country. So the United States realized that they wanted to be able to do that. They wanted to be able to fly things over the Soviets, mostly spy satellites. And so they basically said, okay, we will allow you guys to do this if you allow us to do this. And so they both mutually stood to benefit.
So the lead actors here in writing this treaty, it's the United States and the Soviet Union. But here on Earth, it's the Cold War.
That's right. But both countries mutually decided that they wanted to keep their hostilities confined to just one planet. So they said, all right, let's ban nuclear weapons and military installations from orbit, from being put on the moon, from being put on any other planet.
Meanwhile, the foreign minister presided at the signing of the treaty banning nuclear weapons from outer space. He pledged Britain's wholehearted support. Without such a treaty, life on Earth would be under continual threat, a nightmare existence. Soviet Ambassador Smirnovsky acted for Moscow. On the right sat the American chargé d'affaires. Other signings were made in Washington and Moscow. So far, 31 nations have joined in the treaty. Between West and East, this is the best cooperation for a long time.
Space is going to be used just for peaceful purposes. We are going to explore space for science, and everybody is going to be able to use it as much as they want without interfering with one another.
What were some of the sticking points, though, in ironing this out?
Probably the biggest one was the role of private businesses. The Soviets at the time were communists, and they did not have commercial players. They did not have commercial businesses. And so they said they wanted space to be accessed only by governments. The United States, while they didn't have any particular businesses at the time that were interested in space, they thought, well, maybe one day this is something that people will try and make money out of. The compromise was the Soviets said, we'll allow that, but you're in charge of them. You are the one that is responsible for all of their actions. Anything that happens in space, even if it's just by a private company, you're liable for. So if a private rocket goes and crashes into a satellite that another country has put up, that country can now sue the United States. The United States is on the hook for any damage that that private company did. And specifically in the treaty, it says that countries are responsible for authorization and continuous supervision of their non-governmental entities, i.e. commercial space.
Which was probably an easier thing to agree to at a time when only the government could get to space.
That's true. For most of the last 50 years, governments were really the only ones that could actually afford to go there. So this hasn't been an issue, but the world has changed now. We're 60 years into the space era, the space age. And right now, a lot of commercial companies have been formed, are being formed. A lot of people are suddenly interested in going into space. You've got companies like Elon Musk's SpaceX, which is a private rocket company that he's talked about taking people to Mars. Jeff Bezos is another billionaire, founder of Amazon. He's got his own rocket company. He says he wants to see millions of people living and working in space. Robert Bigelow, who is known for the budget suite hotels, wants to build private space stations orbiting the Earth and also private bases on the moon.
So what does this mean in practical terms? In what ways does the federal government regulate private space business?
It all comes down to the Federal Aviation Administration.
The FAA plays a vital role in commercial space launch and re-entry operations in the United States. The FAA's Office of Commercial Space Transportation, or AST, regulates the U.S. commercial space transportation industry. So next time you hear about a rocket lifting off or a space vehicle landing somewhere in the U.S., you'll realize the FAA has an important role in making commercial space transportation happen.
They're actually the ones who are in charge of giving a launch and re-entry license. So you want to launch a rocket into space, and you have to go to the FAA and say, here's my plan, here's where I want to launch from. And they're going to say, okay, well, what do you want to do out there? What kind of stuff are you carrying? They're going to review it all. They're going to go to the U.S. State Department. They're going to go to the Department of Defense. They're going to go to NASA. They're going to go to everybody in the federal government and ask, does this meet all of our obligations? Is this allowed? If any one of them comes back and says no, then you will not be able to launch anything into space.
So getting back to that moon rock then, what about mining in outer space? Is this legal?
The Outer Space Treaty actually declares space res communis, which means, in Latin, the province of all mankind. That means that nobody owns anything in space. Nobody is allowed to own anything in space. The question is once you go to another body, the moon or an asteroid, and you pick something off of that, do you now own it or not? There are people who argue that since the United States took these moon rocks and made them federal property and used them, that yes, you don't have to have property rights on the moon or on an asteroid in order to mine them. Another place that we use res communis is for the oceans. The oceans are called the common heritage of all mankind. You are allowed to use the oceans. You can go and fish freely as long as you follow all of the international rules, but you are not allowed to own pieces of the ocean itself. So there are people who say that that is how we should treat the moon, that's how we should treat Mars, that's how we should treat all of these asteroids, which would allow for asteroid mining. And that's the line that the United States has taken. In 2015, Congress passed a law that was signed by President Obama that basically said, yes, asteroid mining is legal, and we've checked, and it follows all of our obligations according to the Outer Space Treaty. We believe that this is 100% legal. There are people who say that's not true. A park, you're able to use it freely, but you can't go and start digging in that park and take stuff out of it and say that it's yours and then sell it for a profit. So this is a line that a number of space lawyers around the world have taken, and a number of countries as well. The concern of certain countries, more developing countries, Brazil in particular, has said that because space resources will only be accessible to a small number of countries, to a small number of companies, it's going to exacerbate income inequality.
The exploitation and the use of outer space, including the moon and the other celestial bodies, shall be carried out for the benefit and in the interest of all countries, irrespective of their degree of economic and or scientific development, and shall be the province of all mankind.
So Brazil, a number of European countries, and currently Russia have said that they would like to see the international community get together and come up collectively with a way to allow people to go and mine asteroids or the moon, and then that international body would take a cut of their profits and distribute it to everybody in the world, basically.
Why would anybody want to do this?
Well, so there are valuable metals that are on asteroids or on the moon in the same way that they are here on Earth. Things like platinum, gold. Goldman Sachs recently released a report that said that the amount of platinum in one asteroid, even a small asteroid, could be worth between $25 and $50 billion. The problem is, if you brought all that metal back here to the Earth and tried to sell it, you would completely crash the platinum or gold market. So what people actually want to do is use these resources in space. You would mine metals from the moon or from an asteroid, and then you would use it to build infrastructure, spaceships, space stations, moon bases, all that kind of stuff out there, and you don't have to drag everything along with you from Earth. Probably the most important thing would be to get that water. Water is something that astronauts can drink, number one. We need it for life. We could probably use it on crops that we were growing on a space station. But more importantly, you can turn it into rocket fuel and basically create a gas station at this asteroid that people could stop at. On the moon in particular, there are parts of craters, the rims of certain craters, that are always bathed in sunlight. So if you put a solar panel there, you would basically have continuous amounts of power. Conveniently located at the bottom of that crater is a place of eternal darkness, which means that it is super cold, and that means that there's a bunch of ice there, including water ice, that you could use that power to mine that water, turning the moon into a huge fuel depot, basically. The problem is that there's very few of these spots. And if that is the most valuable place to be, everybody's going to be rushing to try and get to those places. There's really only a couple square kilometers of the moon that have that kind of value. It's a question of, do we want to have some rules in place before we actually start sending people there? Otherwise, this is kind of a land grab, the Wild West. But as one space lawyer told me, it's easier to have lawyers arguing about things than have a shootout at the OK Corral.
So getting back to that whole, is this legal and why would somebody want to do it question, it's a tremendous amount of investment for something that is unclear and you can't seek investors for.
And that's actually one of the reasons why a lot of these private space companies have been the loudest in asking for new regulations. They need clarity. Some of this stuff might be legal, some of this stuff might not be legal, and you can't go to an investor and ask them for money, for funding, without having a clear answer about that specifically. So there have been a number of hearings in Congress where people from the private sector have said, hey, we need to make sure that everything that we're doing follows the letter of the law. Please tell us how we can do that.
As Blue Origin initiates the application to license our New Glenn reusable launch vehicle, we are encountering conflicting expectations on the regulatory process between FAA and the Air Force. This conflict stems from the lack of a federal adaptation to the market.
Because currently, the FAA's regulatory system was set up just for communication satellites, which stay very, very close to the Earth. It's unclear right now whether the FAA can even grant you a license to go to the moon, to go to an asteroid, to go to Mars. These private companies want an answer to that question before they're going to take this huge risk and try and go after these things.
So what comes next here? What are you going to be watching?
We're going to see what the United States says, if it gives the FAA the power to regulate these new private space businesses. And worldwide, we've really got to see what all of the countries of the world are going to say about whether asteroid mining is legal or not. The world is a lot more complicated than it was during the Cold War, where you had these two sides. There's a lot of geopolitics at play here. Many people believe that the reason why Russia has come out against asteroid mining and the United States' legislation specifically is just to needle the United States and for no other reason. But as soon as somebody starts mining, they're going to want in on the action as well. The big question mark right now is with China, who they're going to follow. At a recent meeting at the UN, their delegates did a very good job of giving credence to both sides. They said, we should utilize space resources. This is an important thing and it should be allowed. At the same time, we need to find a way to balance this so that it's equitable for all of the countries of the world.
But if you can't claim land in space, what about our flag on the moon?
So the flag was a way of saying, hey, the American taxpayers paid for this great achievement of the Apollo program. But Neil Armstrong, in saying this is one small step for man, a giant leap for mankind, and the astronauts themselves actually left a plaque on the moon that said, we come in peace for all mankind. They were specifying that this is a global achievement. This is an achievement for all of humanity and not for any one country in particular.
It's one small step for man. One giant leap for mankind. Oh, that looks beautiful from here.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Andy Pastor, Laura Stevens, Tanya Bustos, and Charlie Turner. I'm Jennifer Strong from The Newsroom in New York.
Love this show? Check out others by visiting wsj.com/podcasts. See our full selection under programs. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.